What should we make about these additional stipulations that the Buddha imposed on this early community of nuns? Was he doing a good thing for Mahaprajapati by establishing this kind of community? I suppose it's difficult for us to judge really a historical phenomenon that operated or that developed in a time and in a context very different from our own. But I think we should probably say two things. One is that in its time, it seems this was quite radical to open up the possibility of renunciation in a formal context to women. So the possibility of monasticism for women has been an important part of the Buddhist community, and it represents, in a significant way, I think, a commitment to the possibility of nirvana and, as it were, full liberation for women within the community itself. So it's important not to caricature the early Buddhist tradition and in any way as derogatory or diminishing the ability of women to achieve enlightenment or awakening in the same way that the Buddha himself achieved it. But it is true, of course, that there have been these additional restrictions on the status that nuns can acquire in the Buddhist community that reflect, I suspect, us we would have to say in some way, the restrictions on the behavior and the status of women in the context, the time in which these regulations were made. In any case, nuns were an important part of the early community, and the monastic practice of women continues to be significant in the Buddhist community today. Now, the early community began as a group of wanderers, of course, but it soon evolved a settled pattern of life, at least during a portion of the year. In northern India, there's a rainy season that arrives during the months of June or July, the monsoon, and it makes the roads, especially, of course, in 4th century BC India, impassable for a group of wandering monks. It's kind of hard to go out on these muddy roads and really do the kind of wandering that you would normally expect to do. So it was important for these monks to find a place where they could settle down during the rainy season for what's called the rain retreat. Sometimes, in the very early texts, they went and stayed in caves or even at the base of a big tree. But eventually, especially with supporters like Anathapindika around, it was possible for them to set up established regular dwelling places where they could live during the rainy season. These originally were temporary places. They'd then get up and wander around for the rest of the year and then come back to these places the next year for the rains. But of course, as the community became more complex and more sophisticated, these evolved into regular, settled monastic communities known as viharas, communities in which monks lived all year round and lived an organized and sophisticated life of a group of monastic specialists. And this monastic practice or this monastic institution has, for good or ill, and I think largely for good, been the bearer of Buddhist civilization really from that time to the present. Monasteries have been particularly important, as you may well know, in Tibet. In fact, one of the best places to go to see traditional monastic practice in action would be in one of the great monasteries in Lhasa or in central Tibet. But monastic practice is important in China, Japan, and of course, throughout Southeast Asia. In its heyday, say around the year 600 or 700 of the Common Era in India, the great Buddhist monasteries were extraordinarily sophisticated and complex centers of learning. They were really like modern universities, like what universities are for us today, and they taught not just religious discipline and religious ritual, but a lot of the secular disciplines, literature and the arts, medicine, and so on, that were part of the sophisticated and intellectual life of the communities that they were part of.